involve a field of troops, a rousing speech, and a million kegs of blood.
If we commit one man, we may as well send 1,000, Wint said. You think they can sweep through the Norren without picking up our tracks as well? With proof of our involvement and an army at our doorstep, what king in his right mind wouldn't take the chance to finally annex us properly?
Talk went on for another half hour, but Wint's cold logic effectively settled the issue. Kalli called for a vote. He, Dante, Tarkon, and Ollivander favoured continued support. The remaining 8 decided to cease all involvement in Norren matters until a later date. While the others filed out, Dante slumped in his high-backed chair. Blaze sat on the table and kicked his heels.
Well, good luck to the clans, I guess.
This is bullshit, Dante said. How can they just turn their backs? We've been working towards this for years.
Maybe the Norren will do all right. I'd rather break rocks with my balls than try to scour the clans from their own hills.
You think so?
Well, probably not. I'd only expect to lose one ball fighting the Norren.
Tarkon tarried with Kalli for some time. With nowhere else to go, Dante sat and stewed, seething over every insipid argument and call to cowardice. Had he just wasted the last 5 years of his life? Had he actually made a bad thing worse? What was the plan from here? To sit in the citadel, making faces of concern while the armies of Garsk stamped, raped, and gorged their way across the Norren lands? Once Tarkon left, Kalli ushered out the last of the servants, retook his seat, and hoisted one slippered foot to rest upon the table.
Disappointed?
Dante smiled grimly.
Why would I be disappointed? It's only my fault the Norren are facing war. I've just been ordered not to help them. I couldn't be happier if you told me my mom had walked back from the dead.
I see.
I suppose you think I deserve this. Well, the Norren are about to be punished far worse than me.
Deserve it!
Kalli laughed scornfully. I am no tame. I don't hand down judgment from my righteous throne.
By and large, everyone deserves nothing. The rightness of this belief is proven by the fact that's precisely what they get.
Now that's a rousing philosophy, Blaze said. The kind of thing that inspires you to spring out of bed, rub the grit from your eyes, and dive right back under the covers.
Kalli flapped his hand.
Listen, Dribblemouth, I'm no happier about their decision than you are.
Could have fooled me, Dante said.
Well, the answer to that quandary is very simple.
Kalli reached out to lower his stiff leg from the table. He stood, cracking his knuckles.
We're not going to do a damn thing the council says.
Chapter 9.
Dante blinked.
You mean to help the Norren anyway?
That quick brain is precisely why I appointed you to the council.
In that case, I have something to show you.
Dante jogged out the door to his rooms, gathered up his satchel, and returned to the meeting chambers where Kalli and Blaze passed a badly rolled cigarette between them.
Dante closed the door behind him.
Under the tobacco, Dante smelled sift spring, an odor of sage and cold winter mornings. It could perk their nerves a little bit.
Kalli favored it when he did his deepest thinking.
Dante placed a lumpy rag on the table and unfolded it, revealing several pieces of cracked skull. Kalli leaned over, smoke rising dragon-like from his nostrils.
Very nice. Bits of dead things.
There's more.
Yes, I saw the string, too. Those are some tidy little knots.
Hang on a minute, you old goat.
Dante stood over the pieces and summoned the darkness to his fingers. Kalli glanced away from the cigarette in his hand, frowning slightly as Dante drew his ethereal connections between the bones and sheathed them tight in the bone's own power. Dante had built loons a score of times now, and the ritual took him less than 2 minutes. Blaze, meanwhile, wandered to the fireplace to poke at the embers with a brass gaff. Dante set one of the completed loons in front of Callie. Wait here. He unlocked the glass doors, stepped onto the cold, windy balcony, and shut himself outside. He pressed his face to the glass to watch the old man, then lifted his loon to his face. Callimandicus! Callie jerked back from the table, gnarled hands twisted in front of his face. Dante chortled and went on. This is the voice of Aron. You are to give the one you call Dante Galland a tower and a harem to fill it with. Callie gaped at the door, beckoning furiously. Where did you learn to do that? I tried to tell you. Dante locked the door behind him, shivering in the sudden warmth. We didn't find the quivering bow, but we found these. This is brilliant. I don't understand why I didn't think of this myself. He turned the bones over in his deep-lined palm, tapping them with his yellowed fingernails, peering into the crevices between the strung-together pieces. He cackled and flicked the loon into the air, snatching it at its apex. Two simple links. Who taught you to make this?
The Norrin who came here with us had one. I think they severed its connections when he left the clan, so I had to deduce how it worked on the trip here.
It won't hold together for long, though, will it?
Perhaps a couple of hours.
How can you tell? Dante said. Because this little wrapper you've got holding it in place is already evaporating.
Callie set down the loon and sat back, beard rolling into a smile.
Still, this changes things, you know. Things are very changed.
Do you think we have a chance?
Hardly.
Callie snorted.
But now's not the time to be worrying about trivial things like chances. Get your Norrin up here. We have work to do.
Callie worked with the discipline of a scholar and the enthusiasm of a field ball fanatic. He examined Morn's earring for 5 seconds before declaring the tiny wishbone-shaped bone was that from the inner ear of a human. He dispatched a servant to the basements to find as many such bones as he could, then set to work on making the loons permanent. Callie had it figured out before the servant returned. The Norrin loons weren't always active, allowing the netherial sheath to recharge, as it were, whenever they were silent. If ever the sheath were exhausted, it would collapse, permanently severing the link. But so long as the loons were used sparingly, less than an hour a day, they could, hypothetically, last forever, or at least as long as the physical object maintained its coherence. They could be further stabilized by employing a second sheath of ether drawn from an inorganic mineral such as silver used in the earring. Dante could no more command the ether than he could leap and kiss the moon, but he took Callie's word for it. The servant returned with several miniature bones and 3 intact skulls, one of which was still wrapped in withered flesh, its hair like dried seaweed. Callie picked the bones apart with scalpel and tweezers and quickly bundled them into 2 new loons. After some fiddling, he sent Dante to the balcony. With the loon pressed to his ear, Dante heard Callie's voice as a low murmur. On attaching bits of scrap silver, the old man wrangled 2 different sheaths, 1 ether, 1 nether. He and Dante spent a half hour running through the keep like children, loons pressed to their ears as they exchanged insults, commands, and cryptic aphorisms. Early morning sunlight splashed through the curtains. Still, Dante could hardly sleep. By the 4th time he woke, he didn't bother trying to lie back down. He dressed, dashed up to Callie's room, and knocked softly. Callie replied at once, clear-voiced, to call him in. Dante slammed the door behind him.
Well?
Callie grinned, blue eyes flashing.
I think I'm going to declare a holiday in our honor.
They still work.
And now comes the hard part. We can't tell a soul about our godlike greatness.
To be perfectly frank, Dante said, I don't understand why this is a secret in the first place.
Cali raised the thickets of his brows.
Are you kidding? This is a highly sophisticated concept. Few enough know how to animate the dead, let alone sense through their senses.
Variations of the idea, then. Like, what if I killed a bunch of eagles, then returned them to the sky with a red cloth in one claw and a white cloth in the other? They could pass a message to everyone watching them in moments.
Or I could park a dead rat in your room, go to the palace in Setuven, spy on the king, and then have the rat tap out exactly what the king was saying.
The old man chuckled. Have you ever tried to make a dead bird fly?
Well, no. It works exactly as well as when a normal person tries it. As far as commanding a rat from 500 miles away goes, have you ever tried that?
I've commanded them 2 or 3 miles from me, Dante said. I didn't notice any loss of control or need for additional focus.
Try it at 10 miles sometime, Cali said, or 20. Anyone can waggle a 3-foot stick.
Try holding up a 50-foot branch sometime. Building such a speech web would require an army of nethromancers dedicated to nothing but making rats tap dance yes or no to other nethromancers. There aren't enough sorcerers and all Gask for that.
Then why do the loons work at such long range?
Those rats of yours tax your hold on the nether at every moment of the day. It's the same way it taxes a warrior to wave around his sword. Most of the time, the loons are sheathed. A sheathed weapon draws no strength from the wielder.
I get it. More or less, Dante said.
So, we've got the loons.
What's next?
We plan your next trip, Cali said.
I don't know about that.
Dante frowned. The last time I was let out of the house, I accidentally touched off a war.
That's precisely why I'm sending you out to undo it. Not for a couple of weeks, of course. I'd like to let tempers cool before we throw you back into the field.
Well, that should give me plenty of time to figure out who tried to kill me yesterday.
Cali drew back his bearded chin.
Someone tried to kill you?
You didn't hear? When I got off the boat.
They were expecting me.
Well, I can't say I blame them.
Cali beckoned toward the door.
Now go get ready for diplomacy. Bathing was a good start.
No sense going to the tailor just yet, Dante said. Not before I know whether I'll need new clothes for the Blue Bloods or to wear at my own funeral.
Speaking of which, I'd like you to take a look at something. It might be poison, so don't eat any of it unless you'd like to make my day.
He brought Cali the vial of black-brown liquid, then found Blaze eating toast and bacon and dried peaches in the dining hall. After querying 2 servants and a blacksmith, he tracked Morn down in the armory, where the Norren was discussing serration with the house arrowsmith.
Lyra took somewhat longer to locate. She had taken to the gymnasium of the auxiliary barracks, which was presently empty.
Dust motes swirled in the sunlight, slashing through the empty windows. Cobwebs strangled the exposed rafters. Lyra practiced in the space at the far end of the barn-like barracks, short sword in her left hand, her right hand empty. She moved as slowly and fluidly as cool honey, her blade tracing crisp patterns, while her free hand moved in concert, clawing, grasping, and twisting imaginary foes. At times, she exploded into furious motion, hand and sword flowing through combinations far too fast for Dante to follow. After one of these flurries, she sensed him and turned, lowering her arms to her side. She wore a light and simple shirt, and sweat shined from her temples and neck.
"What are you doing with your offhand?" Dante said. "That seems pretty intricate for shield work."
"There's no shield."
"But a lot of the time you were leading with it. I'll admit I'm an amateur, but that looks like the first form for loss of unwanted hands."
She sheathed her sword and ran the fingers of her left hand from elbow to wrist of her right.
"Armor goes here. You need the fingers free. Combat is sensitive."
"Not in my experience. Anyway,
I don't see how you'll ever get close enough to use your bare hand.
She gave him a look, then went to the wall where the wooden swords were racked. She handed one to him, hilt first. Come at me. He took two steps, then lunged, his longer blade keeping his body well separated from hers. She shifted her heels, thrusting her short sword left-handed over top of his. As it slid harmlessly past her side, she grabbed his wrist with her empty right hand and collapsed into the gap between them. Her sword pressed against his gut, its short length a sudden advantage.
That's how it works.
She held the pose, steel tapping his stomach, then withdrew. With a hollow clatter, he returned the sword to the rack.
Very clever. Unless they come at you with two blades.
Then my bare hands takes one of the knives from my belt. She swept her arm across her sweat-smudged forehead.
I'm not making this up as I go along. I spent my youth in the Carlins. Their warriors have been dealing with the Anirian pirates for 800 years.
I'm going to speak to the guards again about the assassin. I'd like you to come with me.
Afraid to walk the streets alone? She said,
perfectly expressionless. He narrowed his eyes. Was that a joke?
No. I thought I'd do the right thing and turn you in for assault.
Come on. The others are in the courtyard. He stepped into the cold sunlight while she toweled off and dressed for the wintry air. The gate cranked open as they approached. The streets were subdued. The rowdiest revelers were sleeping it off, regrouping their strength for another afternoon of beer and a long evening of whatever drinks were set in front of them.
Dante caught a whiff of vomit. Urine, too, but it always smelled like that.
The guards who'd taken the body were out on rounds. The attendant in the short stone tower told Dante the body had been moved to the Carnotaurium for storage and study. Figuring it would be faster, Dante climbed the tower stairs and set out across the top of the Pride Gate. Exposed atop the stone, the bayward wind streamed across his face.
"The Carnotaurium?" Morn asked.
"Don't worry," Blaze said. "It's just as bad as it sounds."
"Only if you have the constitution of a daisy," Dante said, mildly insulted.
The establishment of the Carnotaurium had partly been his doing. 4 odd years back, the city guards had been dying in the streets at night, throats torn, bodies clawed bloody, hearts torn from their chests. Witnesses confirmed the attacker had been a great shaggy beast. For a few weeks, there had been something of a werewolf panic. Dante didn't buy that for a second, even after he and Blaze had taken on the case and seen the shredded dead for themselves. And he had been vindicated after discovering the culprit was nothing more than a vengeful sorcerer and his undead dog. The citizenry were glad enough, naturally, for the panic to be put to rest. What caught Dante off guard were the scribe-written letters and visits from the families of those the sorcerer and his dog had killed. Their gratitude wasn't driven by the satisfaction of vengeance or justice, but from simply knowing what had killed their sons and husbands. With the support of Tarkin and Meria, and aided by volunteer monks from the Cathedral of Ivars, Dante cleared the catacombs beneath the cemetery on the hill and installed equipment and storage. A small crew of willing monks was trained for a simple purpose— to investigate any strange or suspicious deaths brought to them, primarily via whatever clues could be discerned with the nether. The Carnotaurium had not been his idea for the name. Laughter and the clatter of hooves filtered from the streets. They passed through the upper floor of a guard tower every quarter mile, where guards glanced at Dante's sapphire brooch and black cloak and waved them on. Once the curve of the Pride Gate took the wall east-west, Dante descended at another tower and strode through the quiet streets. Weedy yards separated the modest houses. A high hill rose ahead. There were no words carved above the door in the foot of the hill. Instead, a stone plaque
bore the image of a millstone pierced by an angled pole. The pole's tip was astered by the four-pointed star of Joris.
"Why do humans insist on putting your dead in their own little holes?" Morn muttered.
"What do you do?" Blay said. "Prop them up at the table?"
"We've seen their funerals," Dante said. "They leave the bodies on the oldest hills. If there's more than one, they pile them up in one big grave."
"I thought that was just for the people they don't like."
"We don't think our dead should rest alone," Morn said. "If you belong to a clan in life, why should you be isolated in death?"
The dim tunnel swallowed them up. A flicker of decay wafted on the breeze. Torches burned from the rough limestone walls. A short, gritty walk took them into a foyer furnished with a handful of chairs and an end table with a small gong on it, which Dante struck. A bald monk padded into the room, nose lifted as if he smelled a pie.
"My old student!"
Knack smiled.
"Come to lord over me with your latest promotion?"
"Someone tried to kill me yesterday," Dante said. "I'd like to see the body."
"Right this way."
Knack padded down the stone halls, exchanging pleasantries. The smell of rot thickened on the cool cavern air. Knack led them to a small room. The dead assassin rested on a stained table, body stripped bare. Knack frowned sharply.
"I'll fetch the Nathwriter."
He padded off, leaving the four of them with the body. Blaze sniffed.
"Doesn't look so tough now."
"Nobody looks tough when their balls are hanging out," Dante said.
Lyra shrugged. "People who fight naked are more frightening than those in full chain."
"I have my doubts," Blaze said. "Let's put this to the test."
They were interrupted by the arrival of the Nathwriter, a man with dark circles around his eyes and an expression chill enough to preserve the flesh of any corpse he glanced at. Which made sense. It was his job, after all, to decide how the dead had died.
Dante nodded at the body.
"What can you tell me about him?"
The man gave him a level look.
"The stab wound tells me he died of a stab wound."
"Any indication where he came from?"
"A womb, most likely."
Blaze paced around the body.
"Look, this justifiably dead person tried to kill my friend here. Anything you can tell us about him would do wonders for our ability to continue going unassassinated."
The Nathwriter sighed through his long nose and closed on the corpse in a single stride. He pushed back the dead man's lips.
"He still has most of his teeth, unlikely to be a sharecropper, but his hands are awfully rough to be a lord."
"Excellent," Blaze said. "So, he could be anyone but the poorest of the poor or the richest of the rich." The man didn't acknowledge this.
"The hem of his cloak smelled like wintrel."
"What did the Nathwriter show?" Dante said.
"Nothing abnormal. You're welcome to check for yourself."
Dante shook his head. "Please hang on to the body for now. Once it turns, I'd like the skull preserved, just in case."
"Whatever you say."
Dante waved to Knack on their way out of the catacombs. Outside, the sun felt hard, the air gentle and pure. "That wasn't half as bad as you made it sound," Lyra said. Blaze rolled his eyes.
"That's because we didn't go to storage."
"Did we just learn anything at all?" Dante said.
"I don't think wintrel grows anywhere but the Gascon interior," Blaze said. "So that rules out our old enemies from Malin. Or pirates."
"Not river pirates," Morn said. "Or land pirates."
Another finger pointing Cassander's way. Dante glanced up. Dark clouds mounded in from the bay, low and fast.
or anyone who wants to get in his good graces, which describes nearly everyone in Garsk. Perhaps it was the comfort of being home after a long journey, but Dante didn't feel all that concerned that an unknown enemy had recently tried to take his life. Then again, this wasn't the first time he'd been attacked in the street. He had a full flask of experience to draw on in comparison. The fifth strawberry never tastes as sweet as the first. So he didn't think much about the dead man as he led the others to the ingate tailor who handled the citadel's ritzier garb. The sharp-eyed proprietor closed her shop and led them upstairs to a world of fur and silk and cotton. Pins and swatches and cloth tape flew as she and her two assistants fitted them for travel and court. The old woman took Morn's fitting as a special challenge. Morn appeared to feel the same challenge about her measuring tape sliding under his armpits and around his groin. When they left late that afternoon, snow whirled down from the clouds. In protest, the Thursday's revelers burnt all the moths they could find. Traditionally, the last days of Urt were associated with cicadas, but Dante hadn't seen one of those since leaving Malin, and smashed snowmen with axes and hoes. Several days passed in complete peace. Dante spent hours discussing his upcoming diplomatic tour with Cali. He found maps of Garsk's provinces, holdings, and fiefdoms, and took them to the monks for copies. He visited with a handful of Narashtovik's lords, merchants, and ambassadors, juicing them for information about the men and families he should most try to sway. According to Kali's scheme, each visitation would carry its own goals. At one manor, Dante might entreat the lord to pressure his colleagues in Setevan to ease back on any measures against the Norrin territories. In another, he might subtly ask a baron to remain quietly neutral should war erupt, or at least provide minimal aid when the king's campaign came calling for men and grain. At yet another household, Dante might do no more than attempt to gauge its master's opinion and remind the man, with Dante's own presence, that other powers and interests populated the lands of Greater Garsk besides those concentrated in its capital. Word arrived the Viceroy of Dolendon and the border towns had banned all Norrin from bearing arms in public without notarized consent of the local guard. Several Norrin had already been arrested. 2 days later, one of Kali's scouts rode through the gates with news the clan of the Broken Branch had ranged across the river to burn a slave camp to the ground. The clan left no living human behind. "It's just a matter of time," Blaze said, after a long time planning routes in his room. "We ought to just dig a huge ditch around the Norrin lands and fill it with all the trash we can find. See if that keeps them out." Dante stood from the desk, knees popping. "Speaking of trash, I'm hungry. Want lunch? 5 times a day. Dante clomped down the back stairs to take the shortcut to the dining hall. The high, wide walls were a product of an earlier time, and so too were the rules of etiquette that continued to govern it. Anyone within the citadel was allowed to eat in the hall, from the lowest charmaid to common soldiers to Cali himself. When there were lines, no favors were to be expected or granted. Most shockingly of all, perhaps, in practice it played out just like that. The few who had issue with such egalitarianism, such as blue-blooded Cav, simply took all their meals in their room or out on the town. This order amongst the classes was self-policing and easily explained. Pull rank on a servant in the hall to help yourself to the last slice of plum duck, and the next time a meal was delivered to your room, it was likely to contain an additional spicing of saliva, hair, and pestled rat feces. So the hall bore its usual assortment of soldiers, footmen, and monks. Flatware clattered from plates and long wooden tables. Across the room, Lyra faced Wint, her back as stiff as charcoal-forged steel. Wint smiled and gestured towards her waist. Her hand flinched. "Ah,
Blaze strode across the wooden floor, sidestepping a servant waddling along beneath a tray of cups and bowls. Dante jogged to catch up.
"My point," Wint said, voice threading through the rattle of knives and laughter, "is why limit yourself to bodyguarding while you're awake?"
Lyra didn't move.
"You're proposing to hire me in my sleep?"
The young councilman shook his head.
"I wasn't aware your services were paid."
Her limbs went loose. Not from a deflation of tension. The alert looseness of a warrior, readying her muscles to react in an instant.
"Stop speaking to me." "Is that a command?"
Wint's smile withered.
"Just where do you think you are?"
"Positioned in front of a rather poor view," Blaze said, slipping between them like a knife between ribs. "But I bet I can pound it into shape easy enough."
Wint laughed inches from Blaze's face, brows bent. "Everyone's forgot themselves today. Officially, you're a retainer of the Citadel, yes? Bound, in other words, to carry out orders from every member of the Council."
Blaze's hand found the handle of his sword.
"Yes, but I have notoriously bad hearing. To me, all orders sound like stab, stab, stab."
Nether flickered to Wint's thin fingers.
"Perhaps your ears are simply clogged, and the blockage can be knocked free with sufficient force."
"Stop this," Dante said. "Nobody wants a bunch of blood in their food."
"Nothing to worry about, then. There's no blood if a man's heart just stops."
Wint winked at Blaze, then turned and strode for a nearby table, snagging an entire plate of skewered beef from a passing servant. Lyra met Blaze's eyes.
"I can take care of myself."
"Why know that?" he said. "I've just always wanted to hit that guy."
"He was reaching for the nether," Dante said.
Blaze snorted. "I've been around you long enough to have worked out a plan or two. Let's see how well you bust those shutters around while I'm twisting your nipple off."
Dante shook his head.
Blaze rapidly dropped the subject in favor of a tirade about the inherent superiority of peppered chicken and herbed kasha, but Lyra was silent, even by her own laconic standards. Then again, she and Morn had been cooped up in the Citadel and its grounds for days now, sitting on their hands, while Dante, Blaze, and Callie schemed and mapped and planned.
"It's the last day of thaws," Dante said. "Why don't we go out tonight?"
Blaze jabbed a greasy chicken bone his way.
"Not if your plan is to go look at churches or attend some play."
"My thinking was more along the lines of eating, drinking, and repeating until our corpses have to be swept into the street."
"That's what you consider fun?" Lyra said.
She came along anyway. Dante took his loon, leaving the other with Callie. Blaze took an emergency flask and an emergency flask. Lyra took 3 extra knives. Morn took himself. Their first stop was just beyond the gates. A similar scene was about to play out in squares across the city, but the plaza between the Cathedral of Ivars and the Sealed Citadel was the most popular by far. 3,000 people ringed a wide, roped-off circle. 12 monks were spaced along its interior. They carried long-handled nets and foolish grins. Spectators jostled, placed bets, exchanged good-natured jeers with the monks. The sun sank beneath the cathedral roof. A gap opened in the crowd, directly in front of the church's doors, revealing an elderly woman. Hollida, the institution's master. She shuffled to the center of the vast ring, head bobbing, a squirming sack tucked beneath one arm. 4 men in black hoods circled counterclockwise among the monks, passing out ceremonial wine.
"Confused, blind, and chaste."
Hollida smiled.
"At least you're not alone."
She whipped the sack away. A blindfolded rabbit wriggled in her arm. Around the circle, the monks chugged their mugs. The crowd whooped as the monks set down their cups and took up their nets. Holida raised her free hand for silence, then spun three times and set the rabbit on the ground. It listed like a hulled ship, careering straight for a portly monk. He swiped at it with his net, missing widely, drawing a hail of boos. A woman sprinted forward, robes and black hair flapping. The rabbit bolted between her ankles. Three others jogged to intercept, holding a chevron formation. The creature veered toward the crowd. They stamped their feet until it reversed course, and straight into an old monk's net. He hefted it over his head, its long legs kicking as he raised his fist in triumph. The audience laughed, shouted, clapped.
"I don't understand what I just saw," Lyra said.
"Narashtivik," Dante smiled. 500 years of sieges and decay has left them a bit fatalistic.
"And weird," Blay said.
"Onward!"
Last light dwindled from the rooftops. Knowing the best taverns were rarely the richest, Dante led them beyond the inn gate to one of the city's less loved neighborhoods. In squares, people stomped the slush and shoveled it to melt beside snapping bonfires. The smell of wood smoke on cold air always made Dante feel at peace. In front of the six-sided spike of Vicarin Tower, a man in a patchwork cloak made delicate hammer strokes from atop the ladder he needed to play the 10-foot strings of his god's harp. The pub hunt didn't start strong. The left hand was too crowded to fit through the door. The pine and hatchet had burned to the ground. Finally, Dante settled on Catton's, a four-story pub and inn with an auxiliary basement they opened for holiday crowds. To a surprise, several tables were open in the main room. Their group occupied one and quickly populated it with mugs of stout. Dante wasn't as enthusiastic about pubs as Blaze, but for his coin, the second drink was always the best. Settled into his chair, that first rum or beer soothing his nerves, the anticipation of the evening to come. The mood of the crowd at Catton's matched his. Placid to begin with, but gradually growing more excited for no apparent reason. By the time the barbacks shoved two tables aside for a boisterous quartet hailing from the eastern mountains, Dante's toes began to tap on their own.
"I think I need to dance," Blaze declared.
Dante glanced away from the short-haired blonde, whose voice was as crisp as her flute.
"I didn't know you danced."
"Not well, but that's why it's fun."
He stood, chair scraping, and extended his hand to Lyra.
"My lady."
"I don't dance," she said. "Meaning, I don't dance."
"How stupid. How about you, Moon?"
The Norin blinked. "Do male humans dance with other males?"
"No, but they sometimes joke about it. Wish me luck."
Blaze swung from the table and approached the hodgepodge of men and women dancing in front of the sweating quartet. He quickly linked arms with a young woman whose white smile flashed between the black brackets of her hair. Each time Blaze stumbled, he leaned in and shouted something above the music. Each time, the girl drew back laughing.
"He's very enthusiastic," Lyra said,
"especially for putting our lives at risk."
Dante sipped his thick and bitter beer.
"Why don't you dance?"
"I have to choose to be thought of as a warrior or as a woman. Shooting for both targets means striking neither."
"I can only imagine."
Lyra laughed in the high-pitched way of someone who's very pleased with herself.
"You bought it, didn't you? Not that it's entirely a lie."
She peered at him over her beer.
"Primarily, I'm afraid I'd break both legs. I'd probably break a third one I didn't know I had."
Dante chuckled. The musicians finished on a stutter of hard notes. The dancers fell apart, laughing and clapping and bowing. Lyra gestured their way.
"Do you dance?"
Just often enough to remember why I never do.
The next dance involved a rhythm of boot stomps and partnered claps that Dante couldn't begin to follow. Blaze blustered through in a flurry of stinging palms and barking laughter. At the end, the dark-haired girl hugged him and left with a wave. He plopped back in his chair, sweaty and grinning.
"I'm not going to ask if you watched," he said. "Saying no would only prove you're a liar."
"We conversed," Dante said, "mostly about the best way to scrape the remains of your partner from the bottom of your shoes."
Lyra clapped her mug to the table.
"I should dance with you after all. I'm much harder to stomp than some waif."
Blaze grinned.
"Another drink first, and much more air. Then we'll see who tramples who."
Air was breathed. Drinks were drunk. The band took a breather of their own. When they returned, Blaze stood up and offered Lyra his hand. She accepted with a curt nod.
"What am I seeing?" Morn said.
Dante shook his head.
"A man eager to make a mistake."
Lyra moved with a rhythm that more or less matched that of the fiddle. Dante thought she'd be clumsy, stiff, openly dangerous with her elbows and toes. But she danced with a martial precision that resembled a less practiced version of the crisp mastery she showed with her forms in the barracks. Despite this, it wasn't unpleasant. Through it all, she kept her limbs and muscles loose, guided by the confident hands of training and alcohol. The players leaned into their instruments, elbows jumping back and forth, the creases of concentration smoothed from Lyra's brow. She flowed after Blaze's lead, matching his steps and gestures as if she'd rehearsed for weeks. Dante smiled. Two people in tune to each other, and the music that brought them together. Years later, he would remember nothing else from that evening, but his memory of the dance would persist with the sharpness of splintered obsidian. Regret came with that remembrance, of course, but also the knowledge that for everything that happened afterward, that song, that dance, that moment could never be destroyed. The final notes swept the crowd. Blaze grinned, slicking his hand through his sweat-clumped hair. Lyra stepped away with a small smile and returned to her chair.
"I hope that wasn't too disgraceful."
Dante shook his head, laughing.
"You did just fine."
Their travel plans took shape. Callie ruled out spending any serious time in the lands directly between Central Gask and the Norrin territories. If it came to war, the lords there would be deluged by the king's men, incapable of the first hint of resistance. Even acting too slowly to support the king's army could result in the forcible appropriation of food, men, and their very titles. Callie would dispatch another diplomatic attachment to visit those lords, and make carefully apolitical promises of Narashtivik's friendship. Dante, however, would be sent further afield. His natural targets would be those distanced geographically and politically from the capital's gravity. A long ride south-southwest would take him to the plains of Tatonin, 80 miles of grain and grassland not far from the Norrin Hills' western edge. They had long ties to their Norrin neighbors. Tatonin had been absorbed by Gask in the same wave of expansion that gobbled up the Norrin territories. Many of its farmers and baronets had never taken to the royal yoke, no matter how many decades passed. It would be unable to muster much in the way of men, but if Dante could convey to its rulers that a Norrin victory would enable all of the eastern states to self-rule, Tatonin might be convinced to misplace its excessive grain before the king's collectors came to call. Dante's second stayover would take place among the lakes of Galador Rift. Some 300 miles further west, nestled between the mountains, the lake's merchants were rather boisterous proponents of preserving peace at any cost. "Calm waters bring many sails," or so their motto went. Dante's pursuit there wouldn't be material gains, but political ones. if he could convince the Trade Nexus that a war against the Norren would be slow, messy, and chaotic, the merchantmen would assuredly pressure Setevan to settle the conflict through gentler means. The third shot was a long one, not just in the sense of the sheer distance to the meandering inlet of Pocket Cove. At least Dante could find the place. The same might not be true of its residents. Even if he could track down the people of the pocket, there were no guarantees they wouldn't flay him on the spot and kite his skin on the beach. With no unforeseen diversions or delays, the trip to all these places would last 2 months, with much of that time reserved for introductions, dinners, and multi-day stays in stately manors. The trip back could take as little as 3 weeks, less if they were willing to kill a few horses. They'd be back by the end of June, in other words. If he planned to take the Norren territories before winter, Modigan would have to commit his forces to the field around that same time. 3 days, Cali said after reaching that conclusion. Dante glanced up from the maps on the table in the old man's room. What about them? That's when I kick you out the front gates. That's hardly any time at all. Blazers had hangovers last longer than that. Cali scoffed, flicking his beard with his fingertips. You have an entire castle at your disposal. If you were feeling cramped, you could clap your hands and have a new house built for you by the morning. Dante blew on the notes he'd been taking. It just seems fast. I suppose 3 days is enough. It had better be, because you'll actually only have two. What? Why the hell did you just tell me I'd leave in three? You will, Cali peered down his crooked nose. But one of those days will be spent with me. It's time you had another lesson. Dante looked up sharply, smudging his ink. In what? Clearly it ought to be patience. Tell me. Poultry farming, the old man said. What do you think? That was the best Dante could get out of him. He left to tell the others the plan and get started on a final list of all they'd need along the way. Despite the details demanding his attention, his focus refused to stay put, returning incessantly to the idea like a dog to a wounded paw. He wasn't sure Cali had given him any proper lessons after they first met in Malon. While Blaze waited for the gallows and Dante fumed, impotent, Cali taught him the secret of blood. A tomb had served as the old man's schoolhouse. His methods, chiefly, had been insanity, but by the time he finished showing Dante how to feed the Nether with his own blood, Dante had been able to carve his way through the dozen guards that stood between him and Blaze. That had been some 6 years ago. 6 years of constant practice with the Nether. What would Cali be able to teach him now? A knock jarred him from sleep. The room was blacker than Nether. His headache implied it was hours before dawn. He put on a robe, opened the door, and stared murder at the waiting servant. This had better be about the end of the world.
Kalimandukus requires you on the roof, now.
The servant's eyes widened.
His words, not mine. I meant no—
Shut up, Dante said. Tell him I'll be up in a minute. And that I hate him. He slugged down a half-empty mug of cold tea, dressed in a thick doublet and thicker cloak, and shuffled up the steep staircase to the roof. Cali stood in its center, head tipped back, beard and hair flapping in the vicious wind. Far below, smoke furled from brick chimneys. Far above, stars burned from the perfect sky. Without clouds, to trap it in, all the day's warmth had been lost. A film of frost slicked the stone.
What time is it? Dante said.
Cali didn't turn.
Does it matter?
I guess I'd want to throw myself off the roof, no matter what time it was.
So you don't think it matters?
Dante huddled in his cloak.
Is this part of the lesson?
Callie's brow darkened. His eyes were as bright as the stars. You're wrong.
When we go to extremes, your wrongness is clear. It's the end of winter. If you were a farmer, you should be preparing your first fields now. If you waited to plant your tomatoes and peppers until the fall, October frost would kill your crops, and then you. That's a difference of seasons. I'm talking about an hour or three, the difference between a normal morning and a pounding headache. So there's no difference between hours. What about days? Will today as a day be different than tomorrow? Dante rubbed his eyes. It would be longer, by a minute or two. If you woke at dawn both days, could you tell one dawn from the other? I highly doubt it. The old man nodded to himself. The clouds would look different, of course, unless something were terribly wrong. The moon, if visible, will have waxed or waned. It will be warmer or colder. The city may be awake or recovering from a feast.
Callie, I feel like I've been swung by my feet into a wall. I don't get where this is going.
Do you think it's coincidence our holiest text is called The Cycle of Aron? Callie waited just long enough for Dante to fear the question might not be rhetorical.
The turn of the Celeset takes 26,000 years to complete. You could chart the stars for years and see no movement, yet Joris won't always guide you north.
He scowled at the stars.
Do you know why Earth's followers venerate the cicada?
Dante shrugged. His cloak slipped from his shoulder, exposing his neck to the wind.
Because they're insane.
Because the cicada emerges once every 17 years. For 16 years and 11 months, you wouldn't have the first clue they existed, but walk in the woods at the end of the cycle, and you'd think the trees grew cicadas instead of leaves.
So, all the world's a cycle. Even when we can't see it.
Callie rolled his eyes.
You are terrible about simplifying things. Could you describe males without invoking balls? Tell me, when you touch the nether, does it always feel the same?
A sudden gust of wind tore at Dante's breath. He choked on the cold air, belching.
Most of the time, it's cold as a mountain stream. Others, it's warm like...
That was not the type of question that should be given a literal answer.
The old man shooed his hand at the stairs. Go back to bed.
Wait, was that supposed to be a lesson?
It's not my business if you can't understand it.
I think that's exactly what a teacher's business is.
So, go to bed. Perhaps things will look different once the sun's come up.
Dante shook his head and headed downstairs. After the freezing winds, the cool stone of the stairwell felt like a lit hearth. He'd been a fool to get his hopes up. Callie was a man of games, most of them stupid. He asked 10 questions to make a single statement. What good would a bit of linguistic philosophy do for Dante just a day before a 2-month trip?
He saw no more of Callie that day. Hours passed in a blur of packing and preparation. The sun set and rose just the same as it had the day before.
Dante's anger at Callie's opacity persisted until it came time to leave. He gathered in the pre-dawn courtyard with Blaze, Morn, and Lyra. They had 2 horses apiece and a whole pile of luggage. No trumpets met them, no honor guards. Even without such fanfare, the council would note Dante's absence soon enough, but at least the lack of ceremony would help grease Callie's lie. That he'd sent Dante and crew out on a simple scouting mission to the Norrin territories. Callie met them just inside the gates.
A shapeless cloak obscured his thin body and wild white hair.
His breath curled from his mouth. Another man stood beside him, fine-boned and trim.
"Everyone," Callie said, gesturing to the man, "meet Fan."
"Well met,"
Fan said cheerily, extending his hand.
"Please consider me your guide through the wilderness that is foreign culture."
"Guide?" Blaze said.
How different can these places be? It's all part of the same empire.
The man shrugged his narrow shoulders.
It wasn't always.
Thank you for the offer, Dante said, but I think we'll be able to handle a few blue bloods. Fan cocked his head, one eyebrow raised in perfect mockery of a bemused scion.
Did you know that in Tantornin it is considered a mortal insult to come to your host's house bearing eggs?
I wasn't going to bring any eggs to anybody.
And I suppose you know every other custom, tradition, ritual, and insult across Greater Garsk? Well, suit yourself. It's not as if the entire fate of Norrendom depends on this trip.
Fan turned to go.
We should take him, Lyra said.
Blaze scratched the blonde stubble on his neck. I think she's right.
Oh, all right.
Dante glared at Callie.
I hope he's more helpful than your advice.
You're still mad about our lesson, aren't you?
Callie laughed.
What if you die out there? You'll regret your ingratitude for eternity.
Do you have any idea how long that is?
You made out like your secret would change my life.
Maybe it will.
Yes, in that I'll never listen to anyone over 50 again.
Ah, then tragically you won't hear me say, "Here, take this for your journey."
He pulled a shallow box from his cloak, lacquered black wood that reflected the wind-teased torches.
"What's that? A present?"
Blaze leaned down from his horse.
"I'll take it if he doesn't want it."
"On one condition."
Callie held a knobby finger aloft.
"You can't let him see them until he says something nice about me."
"Deal."
The old man passed the box with a metallic clink.
"Anyway, let's not make this a big to-do.
I expect to see you again in a relative blink. Try not to let your failures drag you down. It won't be easy to convince others to turn against the long knives of the king."
Callie bulged out his whiskered cheeks.
"Then again, try not to fail completely. If you do, we could all die here, you know."
"I'll see what I can do," Dante said. He nudged his horse forward. It took the first step of what would be a very long journey. Chapter 10 Dante clopped beneath the gate. Its thick stone occluded the stars. He liked best the journeys that began before sunrise. They always had an air of purpose to them. An import so weighty they had to be started while the rest of the world was still snoring. Best of all, when the light finally touched the land, it showed him a different place than the one he'd woken up in.
"Where are we going again?" Blaze said.
"Lyle's balls," Dante sighed.
"Really? Count me out, then."
"We're headed to the plains of Tantornin. There we'll attempt to—"
"I'm just fooling with you."
Blaze turned over the wooden box and held it to his ear.
"Say, what do you think's in here?"
He gave it a shake.
"Stop it," Dante said. "That could be dangerous."
"To us? Or the mysterious contents of this box?"
"Knowing Callie, it could be both." He gestured across the empty boulevard. "If you're going to explode, do it over there."
"Like I'm going to pass up the chance to take you with me."
Blaze unclasped a flat metal hook, brought the box inches from his nose, and cracked open its lid.
"Oh my."
"What is it? A tiny unicorn?"
"Better.
A tiny unicorn with an equally tiny little flute with which it is shockingly proficient."
"Close, but this is still better," Blaze said. "This thing's useful."
"Really?"
Dante nudged his horse nearer.
"Let me see."
Blaze snapped the box shut.
"Uh-uh. You heard what Callie said.
And normally you treat his suggestions the same way you would a spider crawling over your toast."
"I gave him my word, Dante. That isn't just something you throw away."
Dante plodded along. Morn coughed into his fist. Dante shook his head.
All right. Callie looks very fine for a 120-year-old.
Insufficient.
That's a plenty nice thing to say. You're living up to the letter of the law.